All right. We are pleased to welcome our first presenter for this morning's microbiology section, Dr. Jerry Hall. Dr. Hall is the director of microbiology at the Cleveland Clinic, Cleveland, Ohio, where she has been on staff since 1981. She has also served as a special fellow and clinical associate at Cleveland Clinic prior to her staff appointment. Dr. Hall also serves as an educator and received academic appointment at Ohio State University as associate professor of medical microbiology and immunology. Dr. Hall completed her Bachelor of Science at St. Francis College, Pennsylvania, and continued at St. Bonaventure University, New York, receiving her graduate degree and PhD in biology with an emphasis in microbiology. Dr. Hall serves on numerous professional societies and committees and is extremely well published. Also, Dr. Hall was the recipient of the Sonnenworth Award this year at ASM. Please welcome Dr. Jerry Hall as she presents update on blood cultures and rapid identification of agents of bacteremia and fungemia.
I am a clinical microbiologist at the Cleveland Clinic Foundation in Ohio. This is a picture of where I work in the forefront of this picture. And way down out there by the city of Cleveland is our body of water in Cleveland, which is Lake Erie. A little different than yours, but we do have a body of water near us as well. Cleveland Clinic is 1,000, just going to tell you this to kind of frame where I'm coming from. We have 1,000-bed hospital. We are a consolidation of 8 hospitals as well in the clinic area, in the Cleveland area, which include another 500 to 600 beds, so maybe a total of about 1,600 beds. We have 15 or so standing ambulatory care facilities around the city of Cleveland. We have another hospital facility in Florida, on the east coast of Florida, and we're in the process of helping the health teams, if you will, in Abu Dhabi to set up a new hospital, which has partnered with the Cleveland Clinic, and we have some others throughout the world. I tell you that not to brag, although I do think it's a neat place to work, but I tell you that just to kind of tell you the scope of our business right now. We have a reference lab, and we're in the process of expanding that over the next few years under the leadership of our new head, Dr. Candice Marchant. And for all, half of you in the audience or a little more, all of you women in the audience, Candice is the first female head of a division at the Cleveland Clinic, and I'm very proud to say I work there. We've been through years when that was not the case, and so we are moving forward into this globalization and into the real world, so to speak. So kind of delighted, and she's moving into us building a very large reference lab in the future, so we all hope that will be very successful. And I'm telling you that, too, because that obviously impacts in what we do in our laboratory. My connection with bioMérieure, you know, when they ask you to talk, any of you in the audience, or when you do any kind of projects, we all have to give our conflicts of interest. I do some consulting for a couple of companies, not actually many, but with regard to bioMérieure, I actually have been involved in studies with this company since I started at the Cleveland Clinic. You'll get a real good idea of how very old I am. I started at the Cleveland Clinic actually working as a special fellow in about 1977. bioMérieure was in our lab. It was in research stages. It was part of McDonnell Douglas. They were going to take it off to the moon and have an ID susceptibility system in the form of what was then this blue box. And so we worked on it. I actually worked so much on it that I was one of those lucky people who got a salmonella infection from working on it. We were still in the days then, I'm sorry to say this, of mouth pipetting. And so I actually did go home to my mother-in-law's first Thanksgiving dinner with a whopping case of salmonellosis. And my husband, I still remember him telling me, "You have to eat." I said, "I can't." And he says, "There's a bathroom right there. You just have to eat." So I did, and that's how I made it through. But, you know, that's the negative on bioMérieure. The rest has been very, very positive. When people ask me, how long have you been using your Vitek, and let's say Legacy, or as I still call it, Vitek 1, when people ask me, you know, how long have you been using it, I can remember. And they go, "Wow, why do you remember that?" I actually signed the papers for instituting clinically to use it routinely, the Vitek Legacy, on my son's birth. I was actually, no lie, in the hospital signing the papers. He was born on February 26, 1985. He's now 23, and that's when we started using our VITEC legacy. About 2.5 years ago, we instituted VITEC 2. We have a Diversa lab. We use Avandix fish probes. We actually also do a lot of e-testing, as I'm sure many of you do. We have EasyMag, and we have some applications with regard to NASPA. So we do have many, many aspects of BioMarior. I wanted to share that with you. But I also want to share you in the ideas of anti-conflict or whatever it's called. We also have panels in our tray that Microscan and Trek make for us. We have lots and lots of media and other things from Becton Dickinson. We have genome products. We have Cepheid products, and I know I'm telling the choir, all of you have all of those as well. So we think of ourselves as a fairly diverse lab with all kinds of tools, but we've been colleagues and partners with BioMarior for a long time and really do look forward to all of the innovations they are coming out with over the next few years and continue to come out with. I wanted to share this slide with you last before we get into the talk. This is a slide of our first medical school class. Cleveland Clinic had not had a medical school until 5 years ago. In 2003, we opened up our first medical school. It has 32 students per year. It is a 5-year program, and we will graduate our first class next May. Thoroughly, thoroughly delighted. That's me in the forefront with dog. It's not mine, but I love animals. And that was our class. The course directors are sitting in the front with me. There are three of us who run the microbiology, immunology, hematology course. It's just been a delightful exercise in training new individuals. And you best be sure that we're giving them, I hope, a good background in microbiology so they won't order strange tests and strange antibiotics for, you know, so they won't order vancomycin versus pseudo, and they won't order, you know, why didn't you give me that tigecycline versus pseudo or whatever it may be. So hopefully we'll get some of them coming at least 32 a year, which are a little bit more apt to know what I consider the right thing to do with microbiology testing. Probably not 100% of those changes will occur right away, but we can keep hoping. So what are we doing today? When I was asked to talk today, Beatrice said, what would you like to talk about? And I said, you know, you name it, I'll come up with something. These are my list of topics that I'm talking about in 2007, 8, 9, if you will. One of them was on blood cultures. This is a modification of a talk that I gave in Washington State recently, so I'm using these objectives. To kind of provide an update on collection and processing of blood cultures, to describe in just a couple of slides the epidemiology most recently of BSI, bloodstream infections in the U.S. You all know what that is, but we'll go over it a little bit. I actually took the liberty of honing in on these topics, so this is what a lot of the talk will be on. The issues associated with contaminated blood cultures, whether they be catheter-associated or not, and then culture-negative endocarditis on a few slides. And then in one or two slides, I'm going to summarize what actually came out in the topic as big part of my talk, and that is rapid methods for identification. I'm going to summarize and talk about what we do with regard to rapid methods, but there is going to be a talk later on this morning on fish, and so not to duplicate the two. I will mention it, I'll tell you what we do, and mention some other rapid method possibilities, but won't spend a lot of time on that particular topic. So that's what we're going to be talking about for the next half hour, 40 minutes. Those of you who know me, I've been in California a few times. There's no reason for you to know me other than that. But those of you who know me or heard me know that I have never been accused of speaking slowly, of speaking quietly, or of speaking a little. And so somebody's going to have to shut me off at some point in time when it gets too long. I will watch my clock. So if I'm looking down, that's what I'm doing, just to make sure I don't go way overboard. You have the handout. I probably will not get through all slides. 54 is not a whole lot for me. That's the number of slides that are there. But the amount of material on some of them is a lot, so we're not going to get through all of them. But you have them. I'll try to hit the highlights. So I set this up in the form of questions. And the first one is, what is the recommended blood culture for sepsis determination? And I put it on this slide. I don't know how your lab fits with this, but here, let me go with what we do at our laboratory. There should be a minimum of 20 cc's per stick or draw. When I teach residents and fellows at our place about this particular topic, I usually use the word a stick. Everybody understands, stick a needle in an arm and take some blood out. Sorry to make it so basic. But some people have different concepts of what a culture is, of what a blood draw is, so we talk about sticks. 20 cc stick every time a blood culture is ordered. 10 cc's then distributed into the blood culture system that you're using. And we recommend, as does the literature support, the collection of two of these sticks every time a blood culture is ordered. So two 20 cc sticks, total of 40 cc sticks, collected out of the patient over the first, let's say, hour of that blood culture draw. You could actually do that second stick immediately after the first. That depends on how well the patient wants to be stuck again immediately. With our phlebotomy teams draw about 75 to 80% of the bloods at the Cleveland Clinic. When our phlebotomists go around drawing blood, they generally do the one set and then come back and do the second. It gives a little bit of a break for the patient. Obviously, the blood, the area that's being drawn from needs to be cleansed appropriately. Today, the suggestion would be tincture of iodine or chlorhexidine as compared to povidone iodine. Not sure what you're using in your labs. There are a million different companies, not a million, lots of companies out there, including bioMérieux, who have products that you can use for doing this appropriate cleansing. But my recommendation would be tincture of iodine or chlorhexidine over anything that has povidone iodine associated with it. Actually, we'll talk about it or maybe not get to it a little bit later. Application time for both chlorhexidine and tincture, but particularly tincture of iodine, is very quick. You only need like 3-5 seconds. That's probably the biggest benefit of it and why the data in the literature suggests it's better than povidone. It acts faster. And so both of them may be somewhat equivalent if you apply it for a long enough period of time. Povidone just takes longer. When should the blood be drawn? In all honesty, the best time to draw a blood culture is right before the fever. Now, unfortunately, we and our clinicians are not clairvoyant, and so we can't do that. But that's actually the reason in many cases for that fever pattern, the reason why the blood was being drawn. So if we knew that, we could draw it then. But truly, the closer around that time of fever, obviously, the better, because that's usually, again, the reason for that fever pattern. Throughout the slides, I've given you references to use at your will. I think we in the microbiology lab, and I know all of you are trying to do this, need to deal with outcomes, need to deal with getting out of the microbiology box, and if it helps the whole lab and every patient out there as well, that's the better benefit than just being a cost saving for the lab. So looking at the literature, developing your own literature, validating what you do, and then making sure it's making a difference is extremely important. So I've tried to give you some articles that might help you out in working through that. How many blood cultures are needed? Our recommendation is in the course of a day, 4 sticks and no more. So every time you order a blood culture, 2 sticks are taken. The second time a blood culture is ordered in that same day, 2 more sticks are taken, i.e. then 4. Recent data, as I've given you the article here, suggests that 4 rather than 3 sticks are probably best in order to recover optimally an organism, bacteria, or yeast that are causing that blood culture. With children, we often get the question, you do too, how much should I draw? Turns out that in any child's blood, just because the volume of blood is lower, there are more organisms per CFU than there are in an adult. Therefore, smaller volumes actually often work. And whether you use a PEDS bottle or put that small volume blood in the regular routine adult, as we will, bottle, I'm not so sure makes a big difference. Studies in the literature would support that you could get away with just putting it in the larger bottle. That's up to you what you choose to do in your respective laboratories. If I don't say it again, though, one of the things that I think is important is to get that 20 cc stick or as close to it as you can in the adult times the 4 sets to max 4 draws to maximize recovery if it's ever going to grow anything in the blood culture system. What about the media? Data would support in the literature. My suggestion would be use an anaerobic and aerobic media. The literature actually does say that in this day and age, the amount of anaerobic bacteremia is probably less than 5% in most institutions, unless all that you deal with are GI and GU patients. In those cases, if there are a lot of surgeries in the genital urinary or the gastrointestinal tract, you may see a little bit more anaerobes, but indeed, most of us are seeing about 5-6% of all the positives that result in anaerobes, whether it be single or polymicrobial. But I do feel that you need to offer 2 different type of media for those bugs to be optimized and grow out. Why not an anaerobe and an aero bottle? If you choose not to go the anaerobe route, though, please don't delete that second bottle and just go for a 10 cc draw. You still need 20 distributed into 2 different type of media, whatever kind of media you choose. I've given you some suggestions as to when you might absolutely want to consider anaerobes if that's an option at your institute rather than the routine. Peripheral blood is always superior in my mind to catheterized blood, but it's not going to help, as we see in later slides, when we find out that at some institutions, 30, 40, 50% of our patients have catheters in them, and many times they do have catheter-associated BSI. And so we have to deal with it. I don't think you can make a policy that says no catheter cultures can ever be drawn. That doesn't work in the real world. But I do think, you know, when someone says to you, which one should I draw, peripheral is the better one to draw in most situations. There are some studies out there that show, though, in one particular study that I give you here, if the catheter drawn hadn't been taken along with the peripheral, a few blood culture BSIs may have been missed because they, in truth, were catheter-associated and the peripherals didn't grow anything. Most situations will get organisms out of both, though. But I think the bottom line essence of that is that when the physician is asking, and please don't stop those conversations, make sure your clinicians are calling you and asking, suggesting both. When someone wants to do a catheter, make sure there is a peripheral as well. Diagnosis and management of intravascular catheters is important. We're going to spend some more time on a few more slides about it. Whether you use an antibiotic attached, if you will, antibiotics being attached to the catheter or not in your respective institution may change a little bit about the kind of results you get out of that particular catheter draw. And certainly catheter removal is an important part of dealing with the catheter if one does think it's catheter-associated BSI. Once you remove it and you send the tip off to the laboratory, I personally am not a real proponent of doing catheter tip cultures, but the good news is when it's done and it looks like it's positive and it gives you the answer, the catheter's out. So that may help with that particular BSI, so I always think that's kind of a good idea. But certainly there are individual patients in which removal of the catheter is not an option until absolutely necessary to do, and there we have to help our clinicians out with comparison of peripheral and catheter draws, with dealing with when we get just our single coag next, and we'll talk about that more. How do we process our blood cultures today? And I can probably put it on a couple of slides here. So you all know that we have many automated systems out there. On the upper left-hand corner, of course, the BACT Alert system made by bioMérieux. In the center, the newer BACTEC system. And on the right-hand side, two of the, quote, older, they're not very old, but older BACTEC systems. And in the lower left-hand corner, VersaTrack. Some of you may have something else out there that isn't necessarily manufactured or distributed well in the United States, but these tend to be the major automated systems that we have right now in the United States that we are using in our laboratories. Lots of different kinds of bottles depending upon the blood culture system you're using, and each of them are labeled for you here and on your slide. In the upper right-hand corner, I've included one that is not the automated system, and that's SeptiCheck. Some of you may use a SeptiCheck bottle for some situations. Certainly if you're doing some work with more fastidious organisms, perhaps, or if you're doing work in the mycobacteria arena, you may be using a SeptiCheck. However, SeptiCheck should not replace, in the mycobacteria arena, sorry, I'm a mycobacteriologist at heart, the SeptiCheck should not replace a true broth culture system. It's a great media, but it's not rapid enough. You need to have it in conjunction with one of the broth systems. What can we expect today from our continuous monitoring system? We can expect most causes of bacteremia or endocarditis will be recovered in the 4 to 5 days that we hold our blood cultures in the laboratory. We hold ours for 4. We've done validation studies to prove it works, that we don't pick up anything clinically significant in the patient after that 4-day time period. Some of you may be holding it for 5. I'm not sure there is a need for holding it for longer than that, but the data would suggest 4 to 5 day holds. You're picking everything up that it's going to pick up. That includes satelliting strep, or all the wonderful new names it's called, abiotrophia, granulocatella, et cetera, et cetera. That includes HACCP. That includes Brucella. That includes many of the organisms that clinicians call all the time in our lab and say, extend that for 10 days. I'm not sure where 10 days came from, but extend that for 10 days, 14 days. We haven't had one recently that said 50 days. Personally, we call on every one of those. And I have the discussion, or someone in the lab does, what are you looking for? It grows all of these. In particular, you want that discussion when it's the first blood culture they order and they're asking for extended and they don't have a clue that maybe that organism will grow out tomorrow that they're looking for. Anyway, good systems, they do culture out bacteria. It's not good for Bartonella, Legionella, Coxiella, a few other what I call fastidious Ella bugs, but you need to know that. Your clinicians need to know that. That's when a conversation needs to go on to use something else, be it an isolator or whatever other mechanisms you have. For fungemia, the continuous monitoring system do a great job for all the yeast. Candida, Cryptococcus, Rhodotorula, Saccharomyces, you name the yeast, it probably will grow out or will grow out in our continuous monitoring systems. What may not are the dimorphics, and what probably will not are the dimorphics. Histo, blasto, cocci, whatever your pleasure is, depending upon the part of the country you live in. And the continuous monitoring systems may not be the greatest for moles, but my own opinion on that is not too many. too many of the blood culture systems we have are great for moles, and you don't know when you get an aspergillus out in a Bactiolert, a Versatrec, or whatever, or you get it even out of an isolator, whether that aspergillus is really causing an infection or is a contaminant in your laboratory. It's difficult and almost impossible to get aspergillus out in cases of aspergillemia or aspergillus bloodstream infection, if there is such a thing. We have gotten, however, in our blood culture systems with Bactiolert, Fusarium. We've gotten Pseudoalacheria boidei, and they have been real infections. So I won't say they won't grow out, but if someone is thinking fungus because you're dealing with a transplant patient, you might want to think of some alternatives, again, perhaps an isolator. But these continuous monitoring systems, I'm beating it to death, really do grow all the bacteria that are common, all the yeast that are common, no need for other systems. Where you want to hone in are the other organisms that it may not grow out, and then you can have some additional media like these. So a mycoathletic bottle from BacTech, an isolator tube. And this would be for your Legionella, Coxiella, if you ever get the request for Bordetella in the blood. Or if you want to really hone in on a Brucella because the clinician absolutely knows that's a very high possibility of what's going on in the patient, then one could consider maybe using an isolator in addition to the routine system. So these are adjunct media that you afford to your clinicians in those situations when they need it, but not every time they want to extend that blood culture, because more than likely, whatever they're wanting to extend it for will grow out routinely if they just wait and make sure they see it in the routine bottle, if you will. So what are the most common etiologic agents in sepsis? A little bit of the idea of epidemiology. Everybody has access to many of the articles, or at least this article that I'm going to show. It is data back in 2004, and you can get your own data that's very similar to this, showing the percentage of bloodstream infections by organism in and out of ICUs. Almost inevitably, coag-neg is top of the list. Almost everywhere, Staph aureus is second on the list. Then it breaks up a little bit. Some of us have more enterococcus than pseudo, depending upon whether you have cardiac patients who are on every antibiotic, surgery patients that are on every antibiotic known to mankind, including pacers and devices inside to keep them going, and they get infected, and enterococcus becomes top of the list. Or a huge transplant service where Pseudomonas may be higher on the list. Or a routine service where the third on your list may be Enterobacteriaceae as a whole, E. coli, Klebsiella, Enterobacter, if you will. But here's the list. In most labs, it's similar. One of the organisms that has now made the hit list, though, as you can see on here, is Acinetobacter baumannii. Certainly has at our hospital. May also have made it at your hospitals. We are seeing more and more Acinetobacter baumannii crab, the carbapenem resistant, and so it actually has made the hit list of really common BSIs, unfortunately. When you're taking this data in your own laboratory, either as part of your infection control team or because you want to have this data and all of you should be tracking this data, I would highly recommend that we do it with some exclusion of mixed patients, certainly, perhaps the first patient isolate or episodic isolates or whatever, so we don't kind of skew the data and we really get a picture of what are the most common isolates. Sepsis in the United States and throughout the world accounts for huge budgets, lots of cost on healthcare budgets, et cetera. And the data that I pulled out of this particular article in 2001, anyway, was $16.7 billion in annual health expenditures. You might read a different article, and it'll be slightly more, but once I get above a million, I'm sort of like, wow. And so $16.7 billion, that's a huge amount of money. False positive blood culture, sort of the essence of this talk, 5,000 to 10,000 per false positive. So when we tell a clinician there's coag-neg, when we tell a clinician there's viridans strep, when we tell a clinician there's bacillus species, not anthrax, and we don't do anything more about it, we do an ID, we do a susceptibility, we report it out, we don't comment that it might be a contaminant, they then often think, ah, I have to treat. I have to give Vanco. I have to give whatever XYZ drug. And those are where the costs go up for what was a contaminant in that blood culture to begin with. We'll talk some about how to differentiate contaminants. I don't have any magical answers, but we can talk about what the literature says, about what we do at our place about it. But contamination is an issue we have to deal with, whether we're using manual or automated systems for blood cultures. It's a fact of nature. We cannot sterilize the skin of those patients we are drawing blood from. If we did sterilize it, it would only be by burning, and obviously patients would not like that as much. You know, talk about not liking tincture of iodine and the stain that it gives you. They're certainly not going to like that. But at any rate, you know, it's kind of funny, but truly it is true. We cannot sterilize that skin. Contamination rate should be less than 3% of the blood culture draws that we have, and you should be tracking that. We'll talk more about that. This contamination is due to a plethora of things, including improper cleansing. But I have to say, our phlebotomists are great individuals, and we teach them, we train them, we give them videos, we go out with them, we track them. We actually track the contamination data per phlebotomist and get back to them in an educational nature, all of which I think is important. But sometimes, even with the best cleansing, there is still some contamination breakthrough. Obviously, if there's no proper training, that's an issue. And as you well know, and I've got data to show you later on, if you have other than phlebotomy teams drawing those blood cultures, your contamination rates will indeed go up. The collection site makes a difference. We get some sticks in individuals peripherally, and they take it from the groin area, and guess what grows out? I mean, you know, so even, you know, we would never, ever, ever say an E. coli is not real. But indeed, when you think about where it comes from and you only get one of those, it's hard to really make a statement on that one. Obviously, we work up all E. coli. But if you get an enterococcus, VRE or otherwise, and it was a groin stick, you got to kind of wonder, you know, is this really the cause of the BSI, or at least that clinician does. And certainly transient bacteremia will account for some contaminations. You know, they're not really truly contaminants. The bug was there, but it was because we just brushed our teeth. And somebody took a blood culture for some reason. We just defecated. Studies have shown organisms are in the blood post that. Animal studies, but organisms are in the blood post that. And so there's lots of reasons, perhaps, why someone might have a transient bacteremia. Likewise, there are lots of reasons why we get blood cultures in the laboratory. I'm sure it's the same in your lab. About 90% of the blood culture draws we get in our laboratory are negative. They never grow out anything. Our administrators say to me, Dr. Hall, can't you get that number a little closer? We're wasting our time on these negatives. And the answer to that is no. The knee-jerk for blood culture is high temperature, low temperature, hypoxia, hypotension, hypertension, and a plethora of other reasons why people would draw blood culture, i.e. our clinicians, and we're not going to change that in the near future. If you see exaggerated blood cultures, you're sitting in an audience and someone's saying that they have 120 blood cultures a day, that's our regular load, and you're sitting in a lab that has 200 beds and you see 200 blood cultures a day, I probably worry about that. I'm being facetious, but indeed, in all reality, most of us see about 90% negatives. 40%, though, of all blood cultures may represent contamination. Because of that coagnag, that Viridan strep, that we often can't decide what's going on with it. The annual cost of blood cultures in the positive blood cultures in the United States, $22 million. Results in increased laboratory costs, as you can see, and of course, higher antimicrobial charges. We are not always aware of how powerful we are in the lab. We kind of think we sit in our lab, nobody listens to us. We call on the phone and say this patient has staphylococcus, and we wind up having to spell it. And you kind of go, wow, what are we doing? But let me tell you, studies have shown what we report on that computer, when we give it a name and we give it a susceptibility, that often makes it credible to the clinician reading that report. That often says, aha, I have to treat this. I'm not suggesting our clinician colleagues, and I do think of them as colleagues, are dumb. But they're using the data we're providing, and we're saying to them, this is real. So think about it when you're doing your reports and signing things out about the power that we often do hold. When I went into the literature for this and the talk in Washington, it was interesting to find out that this whole idea about contamination and what we do with blood cultures, et cetera, is certainly not new and novel to us. People have been talking about it for over 30 years, and there's guidelines out there. And the bugs that we call contaminants were the same ones that were being called over 30 years ago. So it's not a new thing. But the interesting part in microbiology is it's still here, and we don't have the best methods for overcoming it, but we need to continue to work on it. Change is constant, as Herb told us this morning, and unfortunately, this is one place where we haven't seen a lot of change. We're still seeing these contaminants, but that doesn't mean we stop working on it. So, what's a normal contamination rate and what is this rate? This is not me, Hall, but it is a very nice article that I wanted to share with you if you have not read it in Clin Micro Reviews in 2006. And it's an updated review of particularly blood culture contamination. What to do about it? What is it? Et cetera, et cetera. There was a Q probe that the CAP still does perform. You can still participate in. This particular one was reported in 1998. And it was all of these 497,000 blood cultures that were studied by College of American Pathologists in over 600 institutions. And what they showed from collecting the data on contamination rates, they're all defined, what are the contaminants, how do you call it a contaminant, et cetera, they found that the adult inpatient, and actually the outpatient wasn't that much different, contamination rate was 2.5% in this Q probe. It's a good thing. We want to keep it below 3.3%. So you can see the data and the percentiles of labs, where they fell, et cetera, with regard to that. So they kind of devised in about 1998 the idea that about 2.5% is normal. It'd be great if that was zero. We know it's not going to be. So trend, keep records on this, be around 2.5%. The lower than that, actually, the better. They also found that when there were institutions that kept with them for long periods of time, the contamination rate seems to get stable or go lower. So these are people who, because they started with Q-Probe, they continue to track and to trend. The overall findings from this first study of Q-Probe are represented on this slide, and basically just what we said. Higher incidence of contamination when phlebotomists were not drawing it. Tincture of iodine was better than iota-4, at least from the limited amount of study there were there. But most of the studies that were participating in the Q-probe actually did use phlebotomists. It's hard to know what triggered the other, whether it was the phlebotomist or the tincture of iodine, but they came out recommending tincture of iodine over iota-4. Changing of needles. If any of you are doing that between getting the blood and then putting it into the blood culture bottle, you don't need to do that. Studies have shown over and over again it adds actually more possibility of injury to the person doing it, the phlebotomist, and it doesn't decrease contamination rates, so the same needle can certainly be used. Organism ID in the laboratory were important in determining whether it was a contaminant or not. So sometimes we have to do some work in the lab to see whether it fits into one of those contaminant patterns, if you will. But we don't necessarily need to report everything out. We need to tell our clinicians it might be a possible contaminant. And lab interpretations can certainly be used to monitor and benchmark contamination rates. That was actually an outcome of this study with Q-probes as well. We in the lab can do something to help this. As I mentioned, when laboratories stayed with it, and this is 356 institutions that were working with Q-probe over a period of time, and when they continued to track and trend, they actually were able to keep that contamination rate at the same level and not see great increases in it. And you can read through this slide on your own. And if you need fuel for your administrators, when sometimes in their wisdom at your hospitals they decide to cut back on personnel, and who do they target but the lowest paying individuals and have to fire or get rid of all of them, many, many numbers. We did that in our institution. We cut back on our phlebotomy squad, and what did we see? Very much increases in contamination rate. And we were able to use this and other our own data and data from the literature to support the use of a phlebotomy team. So if you need it, here's some data for you. The biggest issue we have in the laboratory and how we can most try to help our colleagues and work with infection control, ID physicians, and all of those other clinicians we work with is determining whether or not an isolate in a blood culture is a contaminant. I find it amazing that in 2008, I'm up here presenting a talk and spending a lot of time about contamination, but you know what? It does cost a lot of money, as I've shown you. It is important. We deal with it every day. So the clinical determinants of a bloodstream infection from our clinician standpoint, fever, hypertension, mental status changes. A positive blood culture goes into that thought process of whether this is a BSI, response to appropriate antibiotics. The difficulty with that third one is that if a coag neg wasn't causing an infection to begin with, patient gets better on vancomycin. That doesn't mean the vancomycin was right. It was a BSI. It just means the patient probably would have gotten better even without any antibiotic in that particular case. So again, helping to determine the contaminants is important. What about those coag negs, viridans strep, bacillus, diphtheroids, both aerobes and anaerobes? These are what we feel and what the literature suggests are the contaminants we need to be dealing with in our laboratory and making some policies or guidelines about. My suggestion, the literature suggestion, to have written policies for single positive blood cultures of these organisms. Report them without further workup if they're only in a single stick, a single set, whatever you call your blood culture in your laboratory, until that second set is positive. We sign it out, coagulase negative staph, possible contaminant. Call the lab if you want this worked up. It will not be further worked up until the second positive culture shows up in our laboratory. And we actually have a defined period of time of about 48 hours for when that second culture will show up. That will then call it real and work it up. We share those policies with our clinical colleagues. They actually helped us develop them. And we really have seen a decrease in the amount of vancomycin use, which is the ultimate goal, without reducing patient care, without affecting negatively on our patient care. I'm sure you're all doing something very similar to this, but I wanted to tell you what we're doing. Track the number of single blood culture draws. This doesn't work, though, if you don't have your clinicians or phlebotomists drawing two blood cultures, because there's never going to be that second. When studies have looked at the correlation of whether a contaminant-looking organism is really causing a BSI or not, what was very important was to have that second stick in the course of that 24-hour period even to say, yeah, it is there, or no, it's not there, in determining whether that original organism was, quote, real or not. And as I mentioned before, tracking contamination rates is very important. University of Iowa, and I show you the article here, I thought did a really nice job of involving their clinical pathology residents in looking at whether or not blood culture and isolates were indeed contaminants or not. So they had pretty much the same list of contaminants as I mentioned to you. They added on micrococcus, and actually we usually add that one on as well. And the path resident was actually instructed to get involved by looking in the chart in certain situations. You could read through this, but I want to show you this graph. It's easier to look at this. If there was a potential contaminant in the blood culture as defined on the prior slide, additional draws were done or were supposed to be done within 48 hours. If they were, you can see the algorithm proceeds down the left-hand side. If they were not drawn, then the path resident went out and evaluated whether it was felt to be a real pathogen or not. If it was positive, that second draw with the same organism, then it went on. You can see how the chart goes on. If it was a Viridans group in their lab, they decided Viridans group, when it was two, was always real. That was just their decision. That's how they went. So you can see it follows on here. It was said to be a pathogen, and an AST susceptibility was set up. But go back up a little bit on the there. If it was positive with the same organism on that second draw, and the answer to that question was no, that was considered a probable contaminant. No susceptibility, no further workup, signed out as a probable contaminant. If it was positive for non-Viridans strep, but the same organism as the first, then that was evaluated by the resident to see whether or not it was really true BSI or a contaminant. So they actually took it a step further, not just that single, but when it was second was positive as well. So they taught the residents, told them to go out and read the charts. And what they also did was take about 60% of the cases that the residents reviewed and had an infectious disease infection control team look at them to see if they would have made the same decision about whether it was really a BSI or it was a contaminant. So they had a lot of kind of fail-safes on this, not 100% of the check. And they talked about major and minor errors in the paper. If the clinician did not agree with the path resident, that was called a major error, and then on the side of calling it a bloodstream infection, if the path resident called it one and the clinician did not, that was called a minor error. So what they found was the potential contaminants are listed here for you. 58% had an additional negative BC, and that was reviewed by the path resident unless the physician came back and requested a susceptibility. That became an automatic okay. Physician thinks it is, so we'll go ahead and consider it to be a pathogen. 34% require the path resident. So they had to go out and look at 34% of these potential situations. As I mentioned, they considered two cultures of Viridans strep to be real no matter what, and they just went ahead and called it real. And there were 4.6% in which the algorithm was not applied at all. Those were neonates. I'm sure you're the same. Our neonates pediatricians always have different rules about coagnex steph, and rightfully so. So they consider a single blood draw to be significant, and they go for it on their own and work through it, and that's fine. You can see the contaminant category per total of each of the respective organisms and how much times they were actually considered to really be contaminants and not real pathogens, and then the errors. We presented this at a journal club, and a lot of the path residents were very upset in our place about accepting 11.3% errors. Those are the errors between the clinician and the path resident. But, you know, that means there were 89 or 90% that were actually correct. So you can look at it as half full or half empty, if you will. But I think this approach, getting into it, finding out what's going on, verifying or trying to verify whether it's a contaminant or not, is worth the effort, actually, to control treatment of what is indeed a contaminant in that blood culture bottle. And in addition, as it says on this slide, along with saving some money, not a lot, they suggested maybe $20,000 without affecting good patient care. That's good news. But I got to say, every 20,000 counts in micro. We've always been on slightly lower budgets than our clinical colleagues, so I think whatever we can do to save that patient expenses and hospital expenses is really worth it. Avoidance of unnecessary antibiotics, absolute. And certainly education of the path residents. In some of our labs, we're like, what do we get them to do in the micro lab? They have roles in heme. They have some roles in blood bank. What should we have them do in our micro labs? This is one opportunity for them to get educated about a very important topic, if you will. Kind of an easy corollary to that, can we do something from the lab or elsewhere to reduce the contamination rates? A study by a very by a colleague of mine. I have to say, one of the authors on the paper I'm suggesting here is Ramon Sandin. He's a pathologist who runs the South Florida Tampa lab, and he's a wonderful individual. And when this paper was in the literature, I said, "Oh, I have to use it." In his lab in Tampa, Florida, Ramon found that with his colleagues that to save money, there was a movement to use povidone iodine instead of tincture of iodine, which they had been using. So they did it, and guess what they found? The tracking of their contamination rate showed an increased amount of contamination rate when that switch was done. The switch was not done with Ramon's knowledge, I will tell you. But when he went in to investigate, why are these contamination rates going up? This is what he found out. And there certainly were additional costs that were associated with that. So the lab convinced the individuals in administration to please go back to tincture of iodine. And lo and behold, they saw some really reduced rates back to where they wanted them to be, and actually even lower for some of them. Everything was going along really well, and then another year later he said, wow, I'm seeing increased contamination rates again. And what he tied that into the second time around, because tincture of iodine was still being used, was the use of more than 50% of the blood cultures were being drawn from catheters. And I remember he called me at the time on an email, or emailed me, and he said, you know, do you allow catheter draws? And I said, if we didn't at our place, with most of the people being on catheters in the units, nobody would be able to have blood cultures done. So yes, we do accept them, certainly. So he looked into it. So Ramon being Ramon, and I want to share that with you, what he did with his phlebotomist, with his administrators, with infection control, was develop a procedure for drawing blood cultures through the line, because guess what? There was no sepsis being used on a regular basis when those line draws were being taken. Not sure why, but there wasn't. So we instituted this policy. I share it with you. If you find out, you may need it at your institution. And indeed, he was able to see his rates go back to the level they should have been. So when we draw from that catheter, we certainly have to keep in mind antisepsis as well. And this is some summary of that. Like I told you, I have way too many slides. So this is the summary of the results from that study, and you can read that at your leisure. And I say leisure to microbiologists like we really have it. Question number 6, what about catheter-related blood culture infections? Interesting. This is data I looked up for all of us as well. The U.S. purchases over 150 million intravascular devices annually for lots of different things. The majority of these devices are peripheral, but over 5 million of them are actually central lines that are inserted each year. We have over 200,000 nosocomial BSIs that are occurring each year, with the most common organisms being the ones that are listed there for you. And certainly top of the list, again, coag-negative staph. So I know we've talked a lot about coag-negative, or I have, staph, but here we go again with catheter-related, because it certainly comes into play once again. When we put catheters in patients, we also engender the organisms that are theirs' ability to produce this wonderful thing called biofilm. Biofilm is, of course, a whole other talk. I am not at all qualified to talk about it. There are some experts in the field out there, Dr. John Thomas, Dr. Costerton, and others, who really, really know what this thing is called a biofilm. But trust me to tell you, as you know, biofilms, all those devices we put in patients, are wonderful nidus for organisms to set up. These biofilms that then trap the organism, or they get trapped in it, and antibiotics don't touch it, the infection can persist, if you will. And again, we're not here to talk about that only. Here's a definition of catheter-related BSI according to the Infectious Disease Society of America. Bacteremia or fungemia in a patient with an intravascular device greater than or equal to one positive blood culture from peripheral vein, clinical manifestations of infection, no apparent source for the bloodstream infection other than the catheter. And then one of the following: positive result of a semi-quantitative culture greater than or equal to 15 CFU per cath segment, and the same organism from the peripheral blood culture as is being found from that catheter segment. Simultaneous quantitative blood culture with catheter-drawn blood culture, peripherally and catheter-drawn, with a ratio difference between the catheter, where you see more in the catheter blood culture draw than the peripheral draw. Or differential time to positivity, a new term for some of us, at least over the last 8 or 9 years. What's the time to positivity of that catheter-drawn blood culture versus the peripheral-drawn blood culture? One does not need to use all of these methods, but I'm going to guess in your laboratories, many of you are using at least one of these methods. Which one is the best? I have no clue. I really don't know. I don't think the literature tells us the answer with meta-analysis or otherwise of what's the best way of doing this. They all have their advantages. They all have their disadvantages. Let's look at a few. If we're using the catheter tip method to determine whether it is catheter-associated, remember what we said in the beginning, the catheter's now out. to get that tip. The catheter's out, so maybe that's the good news, as I mentioned. You can use the Mackie roll tube. You can use the sonication method. I'll tell you what we use. It's the sonication method for a variety of reasons. But in either case, you're trying to see how many cultures are on that, colonies are on that plate, and decide whether or not, if it's above 15 or some quantity, it might indeed represent catheter-associated BSI. The comparison of the quantitative culture between peripheral and catheter is difficult in most labs. It requires something like an isolator. It's fraught with contamination because you're processing that isolator, and you all know the amount of contamination with isolators can be a little bit higher than what we see in our continuous monitoring systems because of that manual handling. And what's the number one organism that's the contaminant just from processing? Coagulase negative staph, of course. So you add that into there, but indeed, that is a method of doing it. And we could do this time to positivity, and I have a couple of slides on that. The time to positivity between the catheter and the peripheral may not be easy to obtain for all of our systems. They may depend upon the quantity of organisms in the blood culture. It may be affected by prior antibiotics. So there is a caveat on using that, but I don't know how many of you are getting asked to do that, but we certainly are, and it means going to your automated system and trying to find that time to detection or time to positivity, if you will. It's not something that we can automatically get off of many of our automated systems. Here's a lot of words on this slide, but I want you to take this home and read this if you're dealing with this particular topic, the evaluation for the diagnosis of catheter-related infections using strain typing, getting those coag-negs out and saying, are they the same or not? And when you read through this, you'll find out sometimes they are, sometimes they're not. If we hold our catheter coag-neg staph cultures for a long period of time, we might find 2, 3, and 4 different coagulase negative staphs on them. Which one is the one that was in the blood culture? Do any of them correlate with what's in the blood culture? All of that adds to confusion as to whether or not you could really use that method to determine whether it is catheter-related. Time to positivity. Let's spend, I think, 3 or 4 slides on this one, and again, they're there for you to look at the data. If you're not familiar with this, again, the catheter-drawn blood culture, peripheral drawn blood culture, how long does it take for that positive to come out if they both are indeed positive? A lot of the work is done on neonates and peds. I have one slide with adult data, but a couple of slides with neonatal and peds data. You can see from this particular 2 studies that the optimal detection to positivity or time to positivity was greater than 1 or 2 hours. The difference between the two, small, greater or equal to 1 or 2 hours, is allowing you then to say, if it came out faster in the catheter by 1 or 2 hours, then it must be catheter-related. If it did not, not catheter-related. You can see the specificity on that, 71% in one study, 100% in the other study. That's pretty good. Predictive value of negatives, not 100%. With any single patient, some of this falls short. But when you do large studies, some of these methods may have some applicability. You may get requests from your physicians about doing this. Here's a number of adult studies to share with you. Sorry, I guess I only had that one neonatal slide. Here's a number of adult studies because I thought more of us were probably dealing with adults in our respective hospitals. And here's some definitions of what a catheter-related BSI is, as you can see on the left, and a number of studies looking to this time to positivity and the sensitivity and the specificity of that. Take a look at these articles if you're trying to institute this in your laboratory. It's a lot of work to institute it, but it might be helpful in certain situations. I am not recommending that we do this on all of our catheter and peripheral drawn blood cultures. What I am recommending, though, is that if you get the question from your clinician, make sure you recommend they do draw both, because you can't make any sense of it if they're only drawing the catheter. That's probably the message in all of this. And here's some other work that you can look at. The bottom of this slide shows you, if your patients are on antibiotics, this time to positivity kind of takes a second seat. The organisms may take longer to grow just because the patient's on antibiotics, so that may not make up for that differential. I've got some overall comments here. There is literature on it you can use. Predictive values differ between adults and neonates. And for populations, as I said, in large studies, it appears to work. In individual patients, it actually may not. Sensitivity and specificity may not be good use. What I did find, though, in looking it up, and it's always fun to go, well, fun and work, to go into the literature and find out what people are doing that you may not be doing and you may want to use. There are some other uses to time to positivity. This has nothing to do with catheter and peripheral, just with a single with a culture that comes out of either, you might be able to use time to positivity to tell you something else about the organism in this day and age when we want to get rapid methods. A number of studies showed that GPCs and clusters that were detected in less than 14 hours were predicted of Staph aureus, more so than COAG-NAG. The faster it came out, the more likely it was the real bug, Staph aureus. And trust me, I am not saying COAG-NAG never causes infection. We all know it certainly does. GPCs and chains, if it took greater than 24 hours, it never turned out to be beta hemolytic strep or pneumococcus. Less than 12 hours of a GNB was unlikely to be Pseudomonas or another non-fermenter, and it goes on. So ways of looking at this, I wouldn't report these out on the computer, to be honest with you, but you could be helpful to your colleagues when they're asking some of these questions if you are looking at the time to positivity on your instrument. So just some food for thought about ways in which we might be able to get rapid results even without using fancy-dancy instruments or tools. We may have some means right at our hands right now. I already went over the bulk of this or the gist of this, but now I'm giving you some data to support it. These requests we all get in our laboratory for extended hold blood cultures. Already mentioned, I'm not sure I agree with these at all. I'm not sure holding it longer is going to get us anything, with one exception. We have seen Propionibacterium acnes in really true BSI or other situations that result in BSI being caused by P. acnes, and it doesn't grow out in the 4 days that we hold our blood culture system and we use BacT-Alert. You need 6, 7, 8, 9 days, depending upon the volume of or the inoculum of that organism in that patient's blood. So that is one exception. Other than that, I've given you two or three studies on these next one or two slides that basically support the notion that holding the blood cultures longer isn't going to get our clinicians the answer they want. And it may actually give them a false sense of security that they are going to get it. You need to have the conversation. What are you looking for? What are your thoughts? If it is Bartonella, Coxiella, if it is Brotetella, Legionella, if it's something dimorphic fungus, you need to go a different route for that blood culture draw. Mycolytic, isolators, other mechanisms you may have in your laboratory. That's what basically this talks about. One study out of Hopkins and Duke combined on this slide, the study from Ellinger Barron on the other slide, absolutely say there was 0% yield of significant organisms when the bottles were held longer than what you routinely hold it. Wonderful data. The data is about the same as that O&P data that says don't do O's and P's in patients who are in the hospital longer than 3 days. That data also said zero recovery of anything significant. This data is very similar to that. So we need to use that. We need to know that. Share it with our clinicians. What are the causes of culture-negative endocarditis? The next few slides talk about that. There's a study that I have written on these slides that if you're interested in this topic, you can certainly go to it. These are cases of endocarditis in patients in which the blood culture bottles never become positive unless we do PCRs or other more elaborate mechanisms of recovery. And you can see what is listed in that list, the study that I mentioned and the different organisms that were found when they used more elaborate methods like PCR and culturing valves and getting right at the source of the infection, if you will, but it wasn't by extending the blood culture bottles. It was actually by specifically looking for these organisms. Lastly, what is available to us today for rapid methods for ID of a positive blood culture? Gram stains are still necessary, extremely helpful. As I mentioned, that time to positivity, take a look at that article if you want to use it, might be an idea. Some of you are doing coagulase testing, catalase testing, directly from blood culture bottles. Obviously, be careful with catalase. But with regard to coagulase, some of you are doing that directly from blood culture bottles. That's fine. Some of you are taking making your subs and you're dropping discs. You're dropping vancodiscs if you think it's an enterococcus. You're dropping oxacillin discs or suffoxitin if you think it's a staph that's in that particular bottle. We have tools at our hands now that we can use in our laboratory, obviously with validation. Obviously, with continuing to go on and do the routine as well. So we're not getting rid of the routine in most of these situations, but we're trying to get out rapid results. There is PNA fish, and you're going to hear a great talk later on this morning about the application of fish, and I'll show you what we do with it. I've given you the products that are now available, and there are certainly others of them coming out. Or we can go the molecular route. Genome has their SR product, which has now been FDA cleared for both nasal screens as well as blood culture determination when you have a blood culture that's positive for GPCs and clusters. You can apply their method in the smart cycler of molecular detection of both MSSA and MRSA. Soon Cepheid will also have that same application of their system for MSSA and MRSA that they presently have, at least for MRSA right now, on nasal screens. You can go sequencing route if your lab has sequencing capabilities, or multiplex PCR and look at maybe all 16S, all bacteria that might be in there, and then do something else once you find that's positive. And there are going to be certainly more possibilities in the future. We're not going to talk about that at all today, I don't think, but certainly the future, those of you younger than me, are going to see direct blood culture testing out of the blood before it even goes into these systems that we're talking about, but we're not there yet with that. What do we do at CCF in 2008? Every positive blood culture for GPCs and clusters, we fish with Staph aureus. Results are reported by phone. We're planning now to combine that with a chromographer MRSA because our docs love getting that SA real early, but they also want to know about the MR part of it. So combining with that chromographer may the next day give us that answer. We do fish 7 days a week. We only do it in a batch format, though, I will tell you that. So we don't do it every time it pops positive because we have a lot of positives a day, more than 10 or 15. We do a complete AST for the Staph aureus. After that, our docs are not happy with just MR. They obviously want the whole susceptibility. And if it's a coag neg, we do an ID and an AST. Once we determine that more than one bottle is positive and it indeed is not in that realm of contamination. Positive blood cultures for yeast, we fish for Candida albicans presently. In about a month and a half, we're going to use the dual probe. And as if you've already gone in the back, or if you haven't, you can see that there are examples of the traffic light probe that Avandix is offering, along with BioMérieux, with regard to picking up more than just Candida albicans. And we are planning to, as I said, institute the dual probe and look at the traffic light probe. So in summary, blood cultures are commonly drawn on patients in the hospital, obviously, and as outpatients. We didn't even touch the ED. That's the biggest single part of our lab that only sends us single blood culture draws, and we're constantly working with them. We need proper methods of collection and processing. Contamination is still an issue. We all have to work as hard as we can and diligently to cut that contamination rate down, although we're never going to get rid of it, and to work with our clinicians to understand what these contaminants may or may not be. Culture-negative endocarditis is still an issue. We need to deal with our clinicians individually with trying to recognize what these organisms are. Many of these organisms may not grow out in our routine systems. Holding them longer is not going to get them to grow out. And there are some rapid methods out there, and we need to keep ourselves aware about those. I'm not suggesting you all implement all of those, but certainly to be aware of what's out there. My thanks to Beatrice and to Southern California for inviting me to this meeting, to all of you for listening to me, to my coworkers and my family. Thank you so much.